The last book I wrote was about people who are freed by DNA, innocent people convicted of crimes. And that book, I used the names of the defendants because the defendants were the interesting people, right? These innocent people who had confessed or had been identified by eyewitnesses. Today, I'm not going to talk to you about the names of people. I'm only going to talk to you about the names of companies. But it turns out people are very important in the area of corporate crime, since it is people whose crimes may lead their corporate employer to get convicted. So today I'll talk to you about the banker and the foreman, two job titles. And I'm working on this book called Too Big to Jail. It's just a working title, but the idea is to convey the idea that it's not straightforward to convict corporations, and that in fact prosecutors have something pretty complicated and practically difficult that they are trying to do when they prosecute a corporation for the actions of employees. The banker, who I'll talk to you just a little bit about, was someone whose criminal deeds led to the conviction of a major corporation. And the foreman was the victim of his employer's crime. So two people in very, very different positions. I want to talk about the banker just to introduce how it is that a corporation is even prosecuted. How is that possible? But the main draft chapter that I gave you, draft chapter 5 of this book manuscript, is about the victims of corporate crime. And we don't normally think much about who the victims are of corporate crime or whether they have certain rights to participate in cases or what their role is. So hopefully we'll have a discussion of just sort of that and what do you think of that, and should there be a different way that the public or victims can intervene in criminal prosecutions. So here's the working title of my book. Harvard Press signed a contract with me, so I have to produce a manuscript one of these days, hopefully in the next year or so. And that's what the banker looks like, and that's what the foreman looks like, the two people that I'll talk to you about today. Let's start with the banker. The banker worked for the Siemens Corporation. This is a different company. This is the New York Central Railroad, an old, old case. And it's a 1909 decision by the Supreme Court. It's a little bit cut off on the slide here. But what the Supreme Court said in 1909 was that the federal standard for holding a corporation criminally responsible is a master-servant respondent superior standard. So if there is one employee that committed a crime in the scope of their employment, then the company can be held criminally responsible. So it's a derivative type of criminal liability. And there's lots of language about corporations. It was a railroad. Railroads were, some of the most important and significant and powerful corporations in the U.S. at the time. And railroads are physically changing the landscape of the country, leveling mountains, filling up valleys. Of course, they need to be held accountable for the crimes of their employees. That was the reasoning of the Supreme Court. Back to our banker. The banker, as I described at the introduction, was a man who was, he wasn't really a banker, and he wasn't working for a bank. He was working for Siemens, a huge multinational industrial company, which had projects all around the world, building everything from dams to coffee makers and home appliances. But it was particularly the government projects, building subway systems, national identity card systems, and the banker worked in a unit that did telecom work all around the world. He nicknamed himself the banker because his responsibility was to get bribe money to different consultants that Siemens had retained around the world. And these consultants would then personally give the bribes to government officials. And so he describes, and he came forward and talked to German prosecutors and ended up pleading guilty but receiving a fair amount of leniency since he cooperated in such an upfront way. He described how they put cash in briefcases and they shuffled money from different shell accounts. I described how it was sort of irregular transactions in Liechtenstein, of all places, that led regulators to realize that something funny was happening in these different accounts that Siemens was managing. And I also describe how, there may even be sort of a question that you have about that, which is, so there's this banker character who is one of many at Siemens who is funneling cash to pay in bribes to foreign government officials. You know, why exactly do we care in the U.S. whether a foreign company is paying bribes or not to foreign officials? It's a foreign company, foreign officials, foreign bribes. Why is that of concern to U.S. prosecutors? And like you saw when the case was settled, it ended up being the U.S. prosecutors who received the lion's share of the fine payment. U.S. prosecutors ended up being extremely closely involved, although German prosecutors were very much involved as well. They cooperated. Well, it all traces back to a 1977 law, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which made it a crime for companies to pay bribes to foreign officials. And the statute was expanded to include foreign companies so long as they are issuers in the U.S. or have certain other connections to the U.S., including transactions that pass through the U.S. wires. The Siemens Corporation has stock listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They are a U.S. issuer. There's no problem with jurisdiction over them. And in fact, the SEC is involved in cases like this, the Securities and Exchange Commission, because you know people don't typically put bribes on their books or report them in their statements that they have to file to the SEC. After all, paying foreign bribes is illegal. And so if you have slush funds and lots of money that's off the books, that's of concern to the securities regulators, and they were involved in this case too. Today's actually a big day in the world of the FCPA because there are all sorts of legal issues in terms of the interpretation of some of the FCPA's provisions that lawyers have asked questions about and sought further guidance. The Department of Justice and the SEC have said for over a year that, look, we'll plan on issuing guidance to answer some of these questions, and they finally issued their guidance document, a lengthy report, which came out this morning. So if you want to read more about the FCPA, you can read that guidance document. It's a long report, has lots of details. Anyway, that sort of explains how this happened. You had employees that were absolutely paying foreign bribes in violation of this U.S. criminal law. The company can be held responsible for the actions of its employees under that really broad federal respondeat superior standard. And ultimately, the Siemens company pleads guilty and pays a large fine. The fines, I tell a story about how federal prosecutions of corporations like Siemens have become increasingly important over the last decade. These are average fines based on Sentencing Commission data, and the Sentencing Commission is missing some important things about what's happening in these cases. But even just as a starting place, you see that average fines have gone way up. This is not because many, many more corporations are prosecuted every year. What's really happened is that there are more corporations like Siemens that are prosecuted every year. Really big corporations in really big cases involving massive fines. You know, most companies that are prosecuted every year are not interesting. They're not particularly worth studying. It may be a small corporation that, you know, where the employees engaged in some kind of a fraudulent scheme. The employees are the main ones being prosecuted, but maybe the corporation is prosecuted too so that it can pay the fine if the employees are judgment proof, something like that. Small mom and pop organizations. But it's a handful or a dozen companies every year that push these average fines into the many, many millions. So those are the most interesting ones. And you could tell a bunch of different stories about, well, why is it that in the last decade federal prosecutors have become much more willing to go after much larger companies, the more interesting ones, and the ones that actually pay larger judgments. What I want to describe is, well, first, one more thing has changed. There have been these deferred prosecution agreements, which add somewhat more to the total fines. Deferred prosecution agreements bring in even more of the significant public companies, large companies, into the mix. The Sentencing Commission doesn't keep any information on them. But I do. With the help of our law library, I've been tracking these deferred prosecution agreements for a few years now. I guess it's maybe even more than 5 years now. These deferred prosecution agreements, again, involve many more public companies, plenty of companies on the Fortune 500, just like Siemens was, although Siemens outright pleaded guilty. What a deferred prosecution is not a guilty plea. Siemens pleaded guilty. They admitted their guilt. They were convicted of a crime. Deferred prosecution agreements allow a company to not be convicted, not be indicted. They just simply settle with prosecutors. They may, in fact, their guilt. They may accept responsibility for what they did, but there is no criminal outcome. And in fact, nothing is sort of done on the case. It may be filed in the court, some initial document is filed, but it sits there on the judge's docket. And if after a few years the company successfully pays its fines and adopts reforms, then the prosecutors will go to the judge and say, dismiss this case from your docket. This company has complied with our agreement. We won't go forward with the case. And so it's a way of negotiating extra leniency and maybe a way of not unduly harming big companies, where if the goal is to reform the company, but not to hurt innocent shareholders or innocent employees that didn't play a role in the crime, maybe it's sort of a better way to handle big, complicated corporate crimes. That said, it is a way of giving leniency, and it's, you know, normally you only think of deferred prosecutions being given, say, to juvenile first-time offenders who you want to treat in an especially deferential way, and if the kid stays clean and stays out of trouble for a year, then you drop the case. Well, that sort of leniency approach is now being extended to some of the biggest criminal cases in terms of amounts of money that exist. These deferred prosecution agreements, they tend to involve financial-type crimes. Foreign bribery cases certainly are financial in nature. They involve giving bribes to get business for a company. Many of the other cases involve some form of fraud or another. Many of the cases are prosecuted out of DOJ itself, as in Maine Justice, the central offices, not the individual U.S. attorney's offices around the country. And in general, this area of corporate prosecutions tends to involve more oversight by Maine Justice, maybe on the theory that prosecuting companies, especially big companies, public companies, it's something of public importance. Maybe it requires more coordination from the main office. There was a memo in 2003 to give more guidance on how you approach prosecuting companies. And these are some of the factors that prosecutors are supposed to consider. They don't have any particular weight, one versus another, and there are a lot of factors there. But in general, they're supposed to think about how serious was this case? Does this company have a history? How pervasive was the conduct? Has this company tried to remediate? Are civil fines, administrative involvement enough? A whole bunch of different factors. Just to give you a sense of what the terms of these are like, this is out of a total of 250 deferred prosecution agreements over the past decade. And so, the vast majority of them involve compliance reforms. Many of them also cite to the fact that the company had already done things to reform itself, and even before prosecutors got into the picture, maybe. These orange terms involve maybe more intrusive things, hiring new employees, hiring a corporate monitor, specific governance changes like adding a new compliance official who has the obligation to report to the board. One thing that is troubling, though, is that there are these cases where, well, no compliance is required for about a third of the companies. You know, if the entire point is to give companies a deal and maybe not require them to pay so much of a fine, maybe you don't convict them because you want them to reform themselves, well, how serious are prosecutors about reform if there's this significant group of cases where no compliance is required? In addition, not that many cases where the company is required to audit its compliance program to make sure that it's working. Now, maybe these small number of cases where 65 cases where a monitor is imposed, maybe that's the monitor's job. But do you think, you know, why not require from the beginning that a company actually audit its compliance program, if possible, to make sure that it's actually working well? Again, a lot of these don't require that. Siemens in particular, the company that the banker worked for, paid a big fine. Paid an additional fine to the SEC. They had to admit their guilt since it was a plea agreement. But a lot of the stuff would have been the same had it been a deferred prosecution agreement. They had to hire a corporate monitor. Interestingly, it was a German monitor, a former finance minister. And in another chapter, I talk more about what that monitor did. The monitor was kind enough to talk to me about his work, which was really interesting work. They had to adopt a new compliance and ethics program. They had to cooperate in ongoing investigations by prosecutors here and in other countries. And it, by the way, said that, look, if they breach, then they could be prosecuted again. And prosecutors can make use of all those damning admissions. And so there's a real stick being held by the prosecutors. Should Siemens not cooperate? Should Siemens not really adopt these reforms like they're supposed to? So let's talk about the victims. I have a short little clip here of this refinery explosion. I don't think that was the real bang, but.
In March.
Okay, so let's stop it there before the narrator kicks in. They're talking about the ISOM. It's the ISOM. So I present the story of what happened in this enormous explosion at the Texas City refinery, one of the biggest refineries in the country, a significant chunk of all the gas that we use in this country in our cars comes from this one particular refinery. I present it through the eyes somewhat of the foreman. And while some of the foreman's account of what happened and how he was digging through the debris, moving, burning, and exploding cars off the wreckage, trying to get at the trailer where his wife and father-in-law were working that morning, I mean, it's incredibly dramatic. It's incredibly disturbing to read. But I wanted to present it through his eyes. Those quotes were all from the victim statement that he filed with the court. And the victims intervened in this criminal case to tell the story of what it was like to be injured by this explosion. And you know, he was one of the survivors. He could tell his tale. And it wasn't just about what it was like to be there, to be knocked to the ground, to be looking for your wife, to find out if she was alive. He found his father-in-law's dead body. An incredibly moving and disturbing statement to read. But it's also sort of about this. This is like this, you know, diagram of what happened. And putting to one side, you know, how the explosion happened, basically it's a giant still with, you know, stuff being heated by furnaces and these, you know, petrochemicals are being heated to distill high octane material to make high octane performance gasoline. But when you're heating up petroleum and you have lots of hot vapor coming out, right, there need to be safety precautions in place so that the whole thing doesn't explode. And from his perspective, the foreman, right, he had nothing to do with this ISOM unit, this isomerization unit that was distilling these high octane fluids. That wasn't his job. He had a totally unrelated job. And the trailer where his father-in-law and wife worked, they had nothing to do with that unit either. But they had something to do with it in terms of physical proximity. The trailer where they worked, it was just 100, 200 yards away from this big unit. And so they had no way of knowing that this unit and the boilers and everything were being restarted that morning after having been turned off for weeks. They had no way of knowing that there was an emergency situation. There were no sirens or anything like that. And so what he describes in his statement is not just what it was like being there at the scene, but that this was a total surprise. No one told them that a big operation was going on next door at this unit. There were no alarms, and in fact, they were concerned that they were working so close to this thing, but when they raised the concerns, no one did anything about it. And so all of that made his statement really powerful. Now, there was no question here about should BP, or really their North American subsidiary, BP Products North America, be held criminally liable. They were willing to plead guilty. They were not asking for a deferred prosecution agreement. The question was, what role should the foreman play and the others like him, the victims? Should they have a say in what the terms would be, assuming BP is going to plead guilty, which they were willing to do? And this shows how the accident happened. That's the actual truck that was idling, and the sparks from its exhaust ignited this huge blast. There's a BP's environmentally friendly Sunburst logo. Right, BP was trying to market itself as a more environmentally friendly company at this point. This is a picture of what it was like there from a report that was done by federal investigators. BP was convicted under the Bhopal provisions of the Clean Air Act, which was amended after this Union Carbide disaster in India, to basically require that facilities like this have careful risk assessment plans and safety plans in place for equipment that could potentially release, even accidentally, certain types of chemicals. And when you had a huge tower here that absolutely had, you know, high pressure heated up petroleum in it, releases were a danger. Releases had occurred. They needed to have a plan in place to maintain the integrity of key process equipment, things like that. Their plan wasn't in compliance to the extent that they had such a plan. It had to be a knowing violation, though. They had to, you know, knowingly isn't that high a mental state necessarily under the federal criminal statutes. But the plea agreement, you know, included ready admissions by PP that they were aware that there had been prior releases directly into the open air from this stack, which ended up being the stack where the blowout sort of occurred. There had been release of liquids and not vapor, which they called puking for whatever reason. There had been repeated fires at the particular stack that exploded. So there have been fires, admissions, all kinds of problems. This was sort of just the tip of it. There was much more that they knew. But there wasn't difficulty in showing liability. The real question was, okay, so they're pleading guilty. What will the consequence be? And here's more that began to come out along the road to the plea agreement. You know, early on in 2005 after this explosion, prosecutors weren't exactly in the picture. Regulators were in the picture. And OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, got involved because there was worker safety at issue here. And they entered an agreement requiring BP to fix up a whole host of different conditions at the plant. Texas environmental regulators got involved, and they entered an agreement that certain conditions at the plant had to be fixed up. But then more came out as outsiders were looking, suggesting that, wait a minute, there was a knowing violation here. There had been no prosecution ever brought under those Bhopal provisions before. And so this is the first case like this. BP asked its own outsider sort of panel to come in, led by former Secretary of State Jim Baker. So they call us the Baker Report. And he talked about, you know, sort of a culture of not caring about process safety or not ensuring effective safety, having a short-term focus basically on costs. So that suggested there was a larger problem with the company. A formal federal investigation led to a report that came out in March 2007. This was caused by organizational and safety deficiencies at all levels of the corporation. So in a big picture way, suggesting this is a company that had knowledge, it's fair to blame them for this. Well, how about the victims? So what happened, which was really unusual in this case, was that the federal judge kept the plea agreement secret, kept it under seal. And the judge later explained that this is a case that's attracted a lot of publicity. You wouldn't want to unduly affect BP's reputation by leaking the fact that these negotiations are underway. And so I've kept this plea agreement under seal until you know, it was entered. And now that it's entered, I'm announcing. And the victim said, well, wait a minute, what about us? We have a right to participate. We'd like to provide input into these negotiations. The plea agreement called for a $50 million fine, called for 3 years of probation, and basically said that BP had to comply with these detailed agreements they were already working on complying with OSHA and the Texas regulators. And so the victims, under the Crime Victims Act, have a right to be given notice of something like this, that the criminal case has been filed and that they're they have a right to participate. So if there are any public proceedings involving release, plea, sentencing, or any parole proceeding, well, the judge kept these proceedings not public and sealed them. Did that mean that they wouldn't have a right to participate? They also have a right to full and timely restitution, to be compensated. These victims in particular actually weren't seeking compensation so much. Like I mentioned, the foreman had already settled his civil case and his wife's, his family's civil case. The victims had all basically settled with BP, having filed their own private civil suits. So they weren't looking for money. And in that case, you know, well, what were they looking for? What was their point? What was the reason? What would they have to offer should they participate in the plea hearing or in the sentencing hearing? Well, they were certainly crime victims. They were directly and proximately harmed as a result of the commission of the offense. Maybe you could ask whether people in Texas City itself who didn't work on the plant, maybe if stuff fell down on their house, you know, were they direct victims? Were they proximate enough? Maybe, maybe not. But there are plenty of people who are at the explosion site who were direct victims. Was this a case where there were multiple victims and it would be too complicated or it would prolong the proceedings to let them be involved? there weren't thousands of victims here. There were, you know, a couple hundred victims. So the foreman appealed and actually got a mandamus granted by the Fifth Circuit. And I don't know if you've come across mandamus too much in your classes, but it's highly unusual for a court of appeals to grant a mandamus and issue an order like this. And the Fifth Circuit, in very strong language, this is only some of the strong language that they used, said that these ex parte proceedings had no precedent. It was contrary to the Crime Victims' Rights Act for the judge to basically lock the victims out of this. And so when it goes back, the judge now has to let the victims participate. And so there has to be a hearing. And at that hearing, victim statements come in, like the statement that the foreman gave describing what happened to him. And in general, what the victims' lawyers want to say is $50 million is nothing for BP. It's nothing. It may be much higher than the maximum sentence under the particular Bhopal provisions, but there's an alternative way of sentencing a company, which is up to twice the loss to victims or twice the gains to the company. And they said no matter which way you look at it, there are billions of dollars in damage caused by this, some to the plant, but huge damage is being claimed by victims in their own suits, much more than $50 million, and it can be up to twice that. Or if you look at the profits, how do you think about the profits? You know, the profits that BP made from this refinery, you know, in a couple of days, maybe much more than $50 million. They said the poor conditions at this plant led them to even get a property tax abatement from the locals in Texas, which was worth more than $50 million a year. And those poor conditions were the kind of thing that led to this explosion. So they said this money is nothing. And then they said, well, forget about money. We're not trying to get money for ourselves anyway. You're putting them on 3 years probation, and you say that they have to comply with these regulators. But there's no independent monitor who's going to be on site, like the compliance monitor in the Siemens case. Someone who's going to be there to make sure that they're actually doing this stuff. And it's 2007 now. We don't think that they're actually doing this stuff. There have been additional deaths at the refinery. We don't think they're going to change things. We think that the culture of sort of poor safety compliance is so ingrained that nothing is going to change. That's what they said, and they could point to evidence that they got in their civil cases. There isn't much discovery in criminal cases typically, but the victims had civil plaintiffs' lawyers, Texas plaintiffs' lawyers. They'd done all kinds of depositions. They had deposed the chief executive of BP. Right? You wouldn't have depositions like this in a criminal case. Maybe if there was a trial, people would have to testify. But in some sense, they had more material than the prosecutors had even about what was going on at BP. So they came in and said, look at our depositions. They have this example of the chief executive saying, basically, do you know how these unsafe conditions came about? I don't know how the trailers got there. I believe no one knew the level of risk at Texas City. And he complained that he had to use one of his vacation days to go to Texas City after the explosion, which was unpleasant evidence. Then they deposed the CEO of BP at the time over video. I wasn't aware of that. I don't recall. He basically was lots of I don't recall type answers. Maybe powerful stuff for a civil case, but this was a criminal case. And in the criminal case, the victims made their statements. He said, you know, I don't think that BP can be trusted. After my civil settlement, they tried to not pay the hospital for my medical bills. You know, I don't trust them. You shouldn't either. Well, did the judge have to listen? And basically, this is a long timeline. They agree to plead guilty. The victims intervene. BP is meanwhile pleading guilty to other crimes involving environmental violations in other parts of the country. The victims finally get their hearing. The identical plea agreement is entered again. Nothing changes. And the judge says, look, I don't have much authority to approve or not approve a plea agreement. And that's right. The federal rules of criminal procedure say that a judge can reject a plea agreement outright if it's manifestly unjust. But a judge can't edit the terms of the agreement and say, well, I think the fine should be a little bit different. And the judge said, I can't say that this entire agreement is unjust. And I don't have authority to make particular changes. The victim said, well, how about just as a condition of probation, which you do have complete authority of, ordering that there be some monitor or something else to make sure that BP actually improves safety at this plant? And the judge basically said, well, you know, OSHA's involved, the EPA is involved, Texas regulators are involved, I trust them. Maybe the judge was wrong to trust them, and maybe the victims sort of ultimately get vindicated, because later that year, OSHA cites continued noncompliance, failures to improve or correct the integrity of some of the equipment there. An additional fine is paid. The next year, there's a new EPA civil consent decree, another big fine over the failure to comply with everything that they were supposed to be doing to fix up the refinery. So in a sense, the victims were right. Things were happening too slowly. BP wasn't complying. Even then, the victims came back then. I don't have a bullet point here for it, but they came back and said, look, we told you, you should find them in violation of probation. They are not complying with what they're supposed to be doing to fix up this refinery. We should extend the terms of this plea agreement. You should consider it a breach. Maybe you should prosecute them. Something more serious should happen. You know, paying a little additional fine, that's nothing when they're not doing expensive things that could save a lot of lives. And the Department of Justice apparently considered whether it might move to have the plea agreement scotched or probation extended or consider this a violation, and they decided not to. And then, not long after that, there's the Deepwater Horizon explosion in the Gulf. And the victims once again say, I told you so. Now, the final part of the chapter talks about other cases where the victims want money. I say that, you know, there are these mandatory restitution acts, which include a lot of the crimes that will tend to come up in corporate prosecutions, including any offense involving fraud or deceit. Restitution is mandatory then, but then there's the question of how do you locate all the victims? What if, like in the BP case, they've already filed civil cases, they can't be compensated twice for their injuries. There's a provision that says, well, if it's really complicated or would prolong the sentencing process, maybe you don't need to provide restitution to victims. It sort of offers judges an out. I describe how judges actually have tackled some really big restitution cases involving quite significant amounts of money. These are total criminal fines, and it's supplemented by my data. The Sentencing Commission, it turns out, is missing information on a number of really big cases involving big fines. Restitution is pretty big, too, not as big as the fines, but in many years, and it sort of varies wildly, restitution payments, ordered at least, are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The Sentencing Commission is missing a really, really big one, maybe the biggest restitution order of all time from 2001. But what I describe is that, number one, just because a court orders a lot of restitution, they have to order it whether the defendant can pay or not. There are plenty of cases where nothing ever really gets collected. They try to seize assets, and they simply can't find the money to give to the victims. There's the separate problem of cases that look like class actions, where you may have hundreds of thousands of victims who, you know, suffered a $25 loss in the value of the stock that they held. They may have already filed class actions with civil lawyers. But even if civil lawyers filed class actions like that, they don't have much incentive to actually fill out the forms to collect $25. If it were a civil class action, the lawyers at least have to send notices to them repeatedly, and they can object to the settlement, and they're supposed to sort of be involved in the process, at least with these constant reminders that, look, you have the opportunity to collect money from this class action. I'm sure you've all received those notices in the mail for one thing or another, and I'm sure most of you don't normally fill them out. Well, in a criminal case, there isn't that same kind of regulation of the process. And plenty of prosecutors have done creative things to hire good administrators to figure out how to distribute the money to victims, how to let them know that this is happening. Maybe they even send out some of the same notices that you would send if it were a class action. But there are no particular rules. And if anything, the rules give judges an incentive to say, oh, this is complicated or prolong the sentencing process, I'm not going to bother. And so I suggest two things at the end of the chapter. One is that in cases where it's about giving victims an enormous amount of money, complicated corporate crimes which involve serious losses to victims are important cases, and they should be treated as important, just like we treat class actions as important, but also cases which involve a lot of people's rights. You know, there should be rules for complex restitution to make sure that victims hear about it, to make sure that they're involved, to make sure that the money is distributed fairly. It should probably be consolidated, like some judges have done, with other civil cases to make sure that they're all sort of handled in a coordinated way. And instead, it's sort of done on the fly. But how about cases like the foreman's case? The foreman had a story he wanted to tell. And in some sense, you may say, well, you know, victims should tell a story if it's a violent crime, and it's hard to understand how it might affect the victim's family, and it's emotional and moving. Maybe it's different if it's a financial crime or something like that. But really what the foreman and the victims in the BP case were standing in for was really the kind of the public interest, saying, you know, we don't want this to happen again. We're not in this for money. We just don't want it to happen again. And we don't think that prosecutors are imposing terms that are truly going to hold this company accountable. And there was nothing for the judge to do. Right? The judge has no obligation to let the public speak, except victims, and certainly has no obligation to listen to anything that they have to say. Now, if it had been an EPA consent decree filed by regulators, a judge actually would have to think about whether this settlement was in the public interest. It sort of accomplishes the goals of the environmental laws. And maybe we need something like that, some provision that gives the judges the authority to think about the public interest when they decide whether or not to approve a complicated corporate settlement. Maybe it's not the same thing as a regular plea agreement where sort of if it's in the guidelines range, it looks like it's a fair amount of years in prison and the fine is about right, that's fine. These cases, it's not about the fine really, necessarily. It's about the compliance and other things that the company is supposed to do to make sure it doesn't happen again. And the judge doesn't have a role. And therefore, the victims may not have much of a role, even if sort of, as a matter of statute, they have a voice. There's no real opportunity for the judge to listen to them, even if, yes, they can say what they want at the hearing and everyone can hear their story. Maybe their story doesn't have too meaningful an impact. So I want to end with one last note and just to bring it back to the banker again. Then the final question is, what happens to the companies that never get prosecuted? If we have concerns about whether prosecutors are doing enough to make sure that companies really fix these problems and do good compliance when they do get caught, then we have to worry about sort of the last note of caution that the banker left us with in the end of a long interview he gave, where he told journalists, look, the 11th commandment is don't get caught. Siemens may have been caught. Maybe they actually did shape themselves up in really significant ways, but how about all the others that don't get caught? So I'll stop there, and I'd love to talk to you about this and see what you think.